Thank you very much for a very interesting opening on all three subjects. Jeff just alluded to the fact that there are very different views between our European allies on Iran. There certainly have been very clearly expressed differences between them on Iraq, and we see that joined now in the current debate. There also obviously are very different approaches to the ongoing Israel-Palestine conflict. And I want to get into that. Before I do, I should like to just make a little plug for a report that is coming out tomorrow, which will be issued by the Atlantic Council and the German Marshall Fund, based on a special trip that six of us, bipartisan, made. Jeff was one, and I another, and several other people here in the audience went along. And we called it the elusive partnership, the very strained differences in approach on these three key issues, which I would say is one of the new manifestations, as Brent Scowcroft said this morning, of the post 9/11 phenomenon, when everyone came together in the beginning on the Afghan-Taliban issue. So while others line up now for the question session, I would like particularly to ask Shibley and Martin to speak a little bit to the point of how the Europeans would approach the Palestine-Israel conflict, how it differs from our own views, and how they might be reconciled. You want to start, Shibley?
Sure. Well, I think the Europeans have a very important role to play, and they obviously have a lot of interest, and one can argue even more than the U.S. in the Middle East generally. They still do not have the kind of influence that the U.S. has, and ultimately, they simply cannot do it on their own. And ultimately, they're not going to jeopardize the relationship with the U.S., the foundation of the relationship with the U.S., in order to challenge the U.S. directly on that issue. And in any case, they can't succeed on their own. So while I think the Europeans have a significant role to play, it has to be in cooperation with the U.S., and I think they've understood that by and large. I think it's ultimately up to American leadership to be able to move forward. One can imagine that they have been sort of relegated to the role of hand-holding and providing economic assistance, which is not a role that they appreciated, particularly because they paid a lot and they didn't have as much influence in the outcome over the past decade, and that to the extent that there will be a cooperative relationship in the future between the U.S. and the Europeans, they would want a little more say because, in fact, the outcome does affect them and they stand to lose a lot if it doesn't work out.
Well, Rita, I think perhaps you should answer the question. You certainly have been there and probably have a better sense than we do of the Europeans. I would just say, as well as agreeing with everything that that Shibley has said about their supportive role, that they can't take the lead, that they have in fact discovered that they can't do it without us, because in the almost 2 years in which we did not get involved, the way was open for them to try to take the lead, and in fact, what they basically did was to come back and knock on our door and urge us to do so. But what happened as a result of that, our reluctance to engage and their determination to get us engaged, was that a new structure has been created. It's called the Quartet, which, as many of you probably know, consists of the United States, the EU, Russia, and the UN. And when the peace process starts to move again, which it surely will eventually, I think that vehicle for EU-US cooperation, having been established and having functioned in a sort of way for some time, will provide a structure for coordination that did not exist in the years, certainly, that I was involved in the peace process. So I think that that's actually another positive development, despite everything that's happened over the last 2 years.
Good. We'll go to the audience now. As we've said, it's hard for us to see you, so we'll just go one in that order and give your name and affiliation.
Robert Cato Institute. There's a line from Shakespeare in which a character says, I can call monsters from the vasty deep, and someone responds, so can anyone. Do they come when you call them? I mean, Ariel Sharon can negotiate with some anonymous Palestinian leader. Can such a person call forth the obedience of the Palestinian people? Who is there on the Palestinian side that can command that sort of obedience at this point? And if no one can, where does that leave diplomacy?
Go ahead, Chibu.
I think it's an interesting question, because it is clear that in the past 2 years, part of Sharon's strategy was to undermine the Palestinian Authority, and I think he has succeeded remarkably. I think the Palestinian Authority has a lot less influence today than it did then. It obviously hurt its own prospects, because frankly, the Palestinian Authority never had as an authority a military option. It simply never had a military option, because once they employ a military option, they will lose. But there is Palestinian society separate from the authority, which also employed, and more significantly employed, violence. And as a consequence today, I think when you look at both the fact that the Palestinian Authority didn't deliver anything after Camp David, and the fact that the Israeli government essentially destroyed the authority institutions on the West Bank, the authority today is a shadow of itself. If you go to a Bethlehem, the Palestinian police is fearful of wearing your uniform, because they're fearful they're going to be hunted as targets. If they want to arrest someone to take them to prison, there is no longer a prison in Bethlehem. They have to actually take them to a small prison in Jericho, and they have to be accompanied by Israeli soldiers and armored carriers to take that prisoner from Bethlehem to Jericho. I mean, it's a remarkable change in authority, and I think that while in Gaza the authority has more, clearly it's less able to deliver. And the dilemma right now is that it's not just Arafat, it's the authority as an authority is a lot less able to deliver. And it's hard to understand how that logic could have worked. And I think that to the extent that Sharon seems to be somewhat optimistic, there are members of the authority who now are trying to figure out a way to reengage. They want to reengage. Some of them, that's the only option, because they're losing the fight within society. And therefore, my biggest fear, which has been from day one after Mr. Sharon came to office, was that you're going to have a process in which you have a decrease in the ability of the authority to control, so they have more anarchy, and more importantly, you have a continuous redefinition of the conflict. To the extent that there has been any optimism about an Arab-Israeli peace for the past decade, it has been predicated on the assumption that this conflict has been now defined as a nationalist conflict of Palestine national movement and Israeli Jewish national movement, the Zionist movement, in which you can have a territorial compromise for a state to satisfy each, the national aspiration of each. That's the only way compromise was possible. What we see today is a beginning of an unraveling of this nationalist definition with the infusion of the ethnic and religious rhetoric into debate. And if this process is allowed, particularly if the Islamist groups take the upper hand, the authority disintegrates, we have a completely different framing of the conflict that may postpone the possibility even of a peace for this generation, because people will find it hard to reconcile a religious beliefs and claims to land. They wouldn't find it as hard to reconcile nationalist claim to the land. And I see that as a further reason why waiting is not going to solve the problem, is going to only exacerbate it, not only because of the process that I described, but because of this additional element which is leading to changing the very fundamentals of the conflict, even separate from the degree to which the authority controls. I believe that the real question ultimately that has to do with the authority itself is not so much how much control they have militarily, how many guns they have against the heads of people. Ultimately, do they deliver something to the people, or don't they deliver something to the people? There is a majority of people who want something. If there is a deal on the table, they will rally. If there's no deal on the table, they will not rally. The reason why moderates in Israel and the Palestinian areas lost hope after Camp David is that there was no deal anymore on the table. And so therefore, they, given that there's no deal, the only thing they had to do was deal with the violence. A deal can be put on the table. I think the authority, in a way, can be revived. even in this horrible shape, if there is something put on the table that revives the hope of the public, and that requires external leadership. I don't think it's going to, the level of trust between Israelis and Palestinians today is such that what Sharon offers is not going to be accepted by the Palestinians. What Arafat is going to say, even if he changes his mind completely, is not going to be trusted by the Israelis. So you need some external factor to change this dynamic.
Thank you. I'll go to the side.
My name is Jim Matlack with the American Friends Service Committee. I think I would follow on from the previous question and Professor Talhami's remarks. It seems to me it almost doesn't matter who the Palestinian leader is if a credible prospect of the end of the occupation of West Bank and Gaza is in view, subject to whatever mutually agreed modifications as in the Taba discussions. But so long as the prospect that Israel is not prepared to leave West Bank and the current Sharon administration acts on that basis in its deeds, if not in its words, then it seems to me that crushes that sense of hope, of optimism, of future possibility. It forecloses a viable Palestinian state. And in that regard, the particular question I would ask is, when will the U.S. government respond in some public and specific way to the repeated violations of Israel when we say no more settlement activity? The settlement expansions continue. In recent weeks, there are new caravans on new hilltops in West Bank, clearly approved by, not countered by, the Sharon government. And yet there's essentially silence or simply reiteration of the formula, but no follow-through. Why should a Palestinian believe the U.S. is serious about even-handedness if this most basic, simple fact about West Bank territory continues to be eaten up?
Martin, for you.
Kind of catch-22, isn't it? Because no Israeli is going to be prepared to support a leader that stands on a platform of ending the occupation until they feel that there's a credible partner on the Palestinian side who would actually deliver on Palestinian commitments not to use it as a springboard to conduct violence and terrorism against Israelis. You know, as I said, narratives are different, but from the Israeli point of view, they offered the Palestinians to end the occupation. They tried to end the occupation, and it was rejected. Now, you know, the Palestinians have a different explanation for that. I tell you, as somebody who was directly involved in it, I happen to agree with that Israeli narrative. There are others in the audience who don't, but I can understand why they have adopted that view, that the problem is not the ending of the occupation, the problem is Palestinian resort to violence and terrorism. But the point is, whoever's right is not the issue, to answer your question. The point is that there is a problem on both sides, not just one side, and you have to address the concerns of both sides. And in that regard, as Shibley has suggested, it's extremely hard for both sides to do that because of the lack of trust, because so much has been broken over the last 2 years. And that's where outside third parties, trusted third parties like the United States, can play an important role. I happen to believe that precisely because of the first questioner's point about the lack of a credible partner that can deliver on the Palestinian side now, for whatever reason, and Shibley has some good points there as to what's happened, it means that if we're actually to get anything in the short term out of this, it would require far greater intervention than just the United States working with both parties. We would, in effect, have to declare a trusteeship over the Palestinian territories and oversee the building of the institutions of the Palestinian state so that there would be an answer to the question that the Israelis ask about who will be in charge of security, who will deal with those on the Palestinian side who to this very day are absolutely determined not to make peace with Israel, who wish to destroy Israel and who say it very clearly, that's Islamic Jihad and Hamas.
Martin, thanks very much. Before, I'll put my two cents in here. Not supposed to, but I will. I think there will be elections. I know there will be elections coming up very soon. I believe that a very moderate to dovish leader of the Labour Party will emerge in Mayor Mitzna of Haifa. I believe the issue will be engaged in Israel before it will be engaged here, and out of that dynamic will come a new negotiation. Mitzna said unequivocally, my policy is as follows. I will meet with Arafat. I will meet with any Palestinian. I will talk to anybody, any place, anywhere, in order to get the process going. And my own view is it's wrong. I don't agree with Martin. It's wrong to count on the United States as the sole and only deus ex machina that always is going to come in with the ultimate solutions and bring the parties to the table. That's my own view, for whatever it's worth. Sam Lewis.
I'm glad you got into the act, because I think politics has been absent from this discussion too much. Martin, I really admire anybody who tries to be an optimist in the current situation. I admire your effort.
My other speech is the four reasons for pessimism.
Yeah. And I was going to pursue you a little bit on your optimism, but instead I want to ask a broader question. And maybe Jeff and Shibley are the addressees here. Let's assume that there is something going to happen in Iraq. Maybe multilateral, maybe not. Something in the next 6 months. Not an unfair assumption. And let's assume also that Sharon remains in office, and Bush remains in office, and Arafat remains in the closet. And there isn't too much violence in the West Bank. There's some, but little by little, exhaustion is having its effect. How does the upheaval out of an Iraqi campaign overturn the apple cart in this issue we're talking about this afternoon?
Very good question. Let's give Jeff a chance here.
Well, Sam, that would depend, in my judgment, on how quickly and bloodlessly the war evolved. I mean, a quick, decisive victory a la Afghanistan, and I think the turmoil in the region can be managed by the Arab leadership, and the Iranians are not going to do anything during the war. So I don't think it really fundamentally would change the situation between the Israelis and the Arabs, except that I think it would then give the Bush administration more scope to perhaps follow through on the 4 points of the president's speech in June, which the last two, which Mr. Sharon's not so eager to see implemented. But if the war goes badly, I mean, if it is a protracted conflict and there are mass casualties because things go wrong in wars, and there are lots of Arab dead on television screens around the world, I think it could be a terribly dangerous situation. And while, again, I mean, the one regime I think that's truly vulnerable under those circumstances is Jordan. And if there were any major upheaval in Jordan, that immediately involves Israel for strategic reasons. The strategic importance of Jordan to Israel is overwhelming. And then, of course, you could get drawn into a much broader conflict. The scary scenario that everyone, of course, is concerned about, particularly the Israelis, is that even if the U.S. operations go well in Iraq, that does not mean to say there will not be attacks on Israel from sleeper terrorists who may already be in place. It does not mean that the northern front with Lebanon could not erupt. There are thousands and thousands of rockets now in the hands of Hezbollah. It's very easy to see how, under those circumstances, the war could get out of hand, and it could escalate into an Israeli-Syria confrontation. And after that, well, then, of course, you're dealing with, you know, a dramatically new situation, rather like the aftermath of the Six-Day War.
Let me add just a couple of things. I mean, there's no question that wars change priorities. I mean, the entire picture is going to change. The morning after, the Middle East will look different. No matter what happens, it's going to look different. And obviously, a lot of governments are going to have to reshift their own priorities, because there will be survival issues related to them very quickly. So no question that whatever calculation in the short term pertaining to the Arab-Israeli conflict there is now, it's going to look somewhat different after.
And although that's totally unpredictable as to what that is, I think we can certainly, we have the power to reorder politics in the region. There is no doubt about it. The U.S. will succeed in overthrowing Saddam Hussein if it goes to war with Saddam Hussein. And the region will change the morning after. There is no way we can guarantee what it's going to look like. There is no way. And in fact, in that regard, I would make just a few additional assumptions to the ones that Jeffrey made. One is that I assume that the regime is not loved in Iraq. Clearly, there will be people who will be very much happy to see him go. But I also assume that not everybody is going to be happy to see the regime collapse. No man rules alone. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to try to protect their interests. We know there are divisions in Iraq, and those divisions are going to matter, both for the effort to keep it in place and for what amount, the amount of resources that we're going to have to commit, the number of years that we have to commit to doing that. Second, that public opinion in the region matters. Most people will oppose it among the public, undoubtedly. In general, I assume that states are powerful. They have the capacity to repress the public. Most of them will survive it, even if, and perhaps we may not even see large-scale demonstrations in some countries because people are going to do preemptive things to prevent that even before it happens. But the consequence, let's not delude ourselves, the consequence will be more repression, most likely, in almost every state where we want to see change. Because, in essence, we're going to be asking these governments either to support us or to do nothing and acquiesce or show themselves to be incapable of responding to the public demand. And there is no way they can do it without being more repressive. And so at least the initial period after, I'd expect to see a lot more repression than democracy. And in Iraq, obviously, almost any regime is going to be better than this one, so there will be an improvement no matter what. But to think that this is going to translate immediately even into an American-backed full democracy in Iraq, I think is not realistic. Are we going to be happy if we have a full election and the Shiite majority wants warm relations with Iran at a time when we want to go to conflict with Iran? Are we going to be happy if the Kurds, when they're really pulled, discover that the majority really want independence or at least more autonomy than the Turks are willing to accept as strategic allies? Are we going to go with that? What will we ask the King of Jordan to do when we know that the only way he can support us or acquiesce or allow us to use bases or do something is to be much more repressive of his people because his people are obviously going the other direction? Will we just, which one will we choose? I have no illusions about the choices that were made. When we are there with American forces in Iraq, the top priority will be to protect American forces, American lives, American interests, to fight the war on terrorism, which is a high priority, to prevent more damage to America and American interests. That takes precedent every single time, and we do it in Pakistan today, and we're likely to do it in Jordan, we're likely to do it in Saudi Arabia, we're likely to do it in every other place.
Thank you. Yes, can't see. Yeah.
I'm Landrum Bowling. I'm with Mercy Corps, which is a relief and development agency working in the Middle East and in the Balkans and elsewhere. I've been three times in Ramallah and Bethlehem and Jerusalem in the last 6 months. And I've been amazed at the amount of anecdotal evidence I have to support Martin's optimistic first 3 points. Quite specifically, there has been a move that I never would have believed would have happened. In the midst of this violence, more and more Israelis have come to the conclusion they've got to give up the settlements. A year ago, I wouldn't have believed this possible. This is a major shift in the attitude of mainstream Israelis. They realize that they have no business there, they shouldn't have gone there in the first place, and a majority are willing to get out. That's an incredible shift. There's also a shift among the Palestinians in that they are willing to finally face the fact that they've got to make some commitment not to force Israel to accept all the Palestinian refugees who might have a claim to go back. That's something that more and more Palestinians are saying, of course. We don't want to go back anyway. Now, my point is this. There's an anecdote that I found on both sides. Somebody says, you know, is there any light at the end of the tunnel? And the answer that I got both in Israel and among the Palestinians was, well, the answer is yes, of course there's light at the end of the tunnel. We can all see the light. We both agree on what's in the light. The only trouble is we can't figure out how the hell to get to the mouth of the tunnel. And when you ask them
thank
what...
Thank you, Landrum.
So this is the question I want to ask is, what can we do to help make it possible for the people there to move toward this possible settlement?
Before we turn that to the panel, I'm just going to take one more question here from this gentleman who's waiting a long time. I'm very sorry time doesn't permit further. Put your question, and then we'll get Landrum's and your question answered together.
Great. Thank you very much.
Don't put your hand on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your talk. I enjoyed it a lot. But I'm a little bit confused about the, comments given on Iran. And when I contrast the situation in Iran and also whatever the International Atomic Energy says about Iranian military purpose on nuclear, and when I contrast it to what you say here, I think there is a kind of misperception, and I have a kind of misgiving about it. And the misgiving is that this kind of perception would radicalize the Iranians, and the fundamentalists in Iran would come on the rise. If you go theoretically, when you are talking about when you want to see a society is military state or not, you see the social process. The social process in Iran is reformist now. You need the popularity of the social process. And when you go to their strategy, the strategy in foreign policy is political deterrence, dollar demobilization, coalition for peace. When you go to the domestic,
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I would like to say
please.
That we have, we have a kind of analogy that Pakistan has nuclearized, and Iran might go nuclear also. While we see the hard fact over there, the hard fact is that the International Atomic Energy goes to Iran and supervise, and they say there is nothing over there. Do you have any hard fact? Because analogy is not a good logic.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's just do a fast roundup then of those two. I have no more time for any other questions, so let's just go back the way we started. Martin, just a couple of seconds, and then down to...
Sure. Just to answer Landrum Bowling's question, how do we help them build the tunnel? I think it starts with small steps, things that we should have already done. The president has laid out the vision, which is accepted by both sides. In fact, the amazing thing is every time we go in, whether it's a tenant to take advantage of the Egyptian and Jordanian willingness to help in training them to reconstruct a capability on the Palestinian side that could confront the terrorists, to stop the violence and terrorism in a climate which is already becoming more conducive to that on the Palestinian side, so that the Israeli army can withdraw and we can get out of this surrender situation that Shibli described. So I think it really begins with security first, and I think that's a critical gap in terms of starting to build that tunnel, which we need to step up to the plate and do
something. Thank you. Shibli, any comment on that?
Just on the learning thing. I think that the Palestinians and the Israelis have been consistently, the public opinion has been consistently favoring compromise solution. Even throughout the darkest days of the violence in the past 2 years, it's been sort of the source of optimism. They just don't believe an option is on the table. That's the reason why they haven't rallied behind one. And I think that certainly some of them have learned on both sides. Many Palestinians have frustrations that they're worse off today and there's no option on the horizon. Many Israelis have learned. But I don't think that in and of itself leads to a cooperative result. You need some leadership, and certainly regional leadership. And I think that we haven't demanded of Sharon to lead more. We have correctly demanded of Arafat to lead more, but we haven't demanded of Sharon to lead more. And I think that the test has to be put forth. If we're not going to lead, we should ask others to do so.
And final word to Jeffrey.
Yes, I think the question about the Iranian nuclear program is a very fair one, because I try to be as upfront as I can. I do not believe Iran has irrevocably, at this point in time, violated the NPT, but I think it's getting pretty close. I base this on what five intelligence agencies independently have come up with. Israel, but you could say that's biased, but the intelligence agencies of Germany, France, the UK, and the United States all believe that the Iranians are doing things they should not be doing, consistent with the NPT. And the best way for the Iranian government to be open about it is to sign the new IAEA protocols, the so-called 93 plus 2 protocols, which were introduced following the debacle over Iraq's program and the failure of the IAEA to discover what was going on there. But the Iranians will not do this for reasons that, you know, in some respects are legitimate. But it was a good question, and it's a difficult subject.
Well, I want to thank all of our panelists. A good round of applause for a very engaged discussion. Thank you.